He's in there laughing his ass off because he knows more about the law than you do.
I'm here live. I'm not a cat.
My law is thy legal.
I will make it legal.
Objection, Your Honor! Strangling a witness!
I'm going to allow it.
We disagree.
That's it? We disagree?
Well, I can't say we agree. That's how I lost my first 10 cases.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 486. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, sir?
I am doing fantastic, except we have not done numerology in a while. I don't know that 486 is a good number for that. It's kind of a, you know, generic even number.
Well, it just reminds me of the old computers. Were those there was like a 386 and a 286. Was there a 486?
There was. Remember. Yeah. Oh, really? It went 8088 and then doubled that to 80186. 286, 386, 486.
Nice.
But at the time, there were some other processors besides Intel that were making knockoffs and can't copyright a number, right? So it was super confusing. So instead of making a 586, 80586, Intel called the chip the Pentium.
Yeah.
And that's when they changed from straight numbers to words.
Oh, so, my God. This was brilliant. Completely
unscripted.
Spontaneous. And it had a legal tie-in. You can't patent a number. That is so funny.
I think I said patent. I meant trademark, but...
Oh, trademark? Okay. Either way. We've got way too much stuff to talk about for this deep dive. Rudy Giuliani's office was raided. Oh, man, I wonder what they found in there. I don't know. Ugh. we got the reapportionment. My fair state losing a seat. And New York losing a seat. Crazy. And then also really good listener feedback on the most recent episode. So first up, though, we always have to have a few announcements. I mean, we can't do the show without announcements, I don't think. It's in the contract. What are the announcements?
So a couple things. I really want to promote next Tuesday's show because there was a little known hearing of the subcommittee in the sub basement, which like six people watched. But I was one of them. And
yeah,
I saw
Biden's speech. Oh, no, you're not talking about
No, I mean, on Tuesday, Sheldon Whitehouse convened a special hearing that laid out the blueprints for, and again, you know, you talk about thinking long term, it's about damn time our side started doing this. In the event that we are able to unpork the court, let's say, for how a future non-right-wing activist Supreme Court could consistent with the kinds of principles I've talked about, show respect for stare decisis, but also overturn Citizens United and maybe Shelby County versus Holder. So I'm very, very excited about that. It's a classic OA deep dive. We're going to do that next Tuesday. And one more thing, obviously, Biden's historic State of the Union-like-ish speech last night. If you want great links, the Miss Ashley's notes that we give away to every single patron contain an awful lot of those that break down some of the details that put some, you know, meat on the bones of what Biden was talking about last night, and lots more. So just good stuff coming from Miss Ashley this week.
One more quick announcement, Andrew. It's the time for another Patreon Q&A. It's the end of the month. I can't believe how quickly time flies, but it is time for Patreon Q&A. We love these. They're so much fun. They're on YouTube for everybody, but patrons get to ask the questions over on patreon.com/law. Andrew will have posted the question thread by the time you're hearing this. So hop on that question thread. If your name is Teresa Gomez, make sure you're the first question, because you always are. So the important thing to note is that will be on Tuesday the 4th at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. So you people on the East Coast, I imagine you can have a nice beverage, settle down. And more ambitious drinkers on the West Coast could have a nice beverage, but a little early for me.
I think we have some trained professional drinkers among our audience. So, yeah.
So come join us Tuesday the 4th, 3 Pacific, 6 Eastern. It's another Patreon Q&A. There's so much fun.
So you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
You just said you didn't.
And happier news. Couldn't happen to a nicer troll. Rudy Giuliani's office raided. I just wonder if he's going to be able to carry on with his podcast. You know, we used it for a lot of movies. I'm going to be heartbroken if they damaged that precious set.
Oh, God. Yeah, they did, take his laptop. So who knows?
Someone had to tell him, that's the thingy you use for the show. Oh, it is? Oh.
So I wanted to say a couple of things. And in particular, I wanted to continue to repeat that phrase, because I really wish mainstream media wouldn't use the phrase raided, right? Like, a raid sounds like, everybody gets together in pirate gear and picks up their swords. And like, was a legal execution of a federal search warrant. So I thought I would talk a little bit about like what that means and what we know and what we don't know. And I want to bracket all of that with, look, what we don't know is a lot, right?
What I don't know is certainly a lot. Yeah.
And by the way, that search warrant, if we see a copy of it, so far I have not, it will be because Rudy Giuliani has given it to somebody. Okay. The search warrant itself is a non-public document until they show up at trial. But when a search warrant is executed at your house, you get a copy of it. So,
do you think they were just searching for the mic? We got a search warrant. We're going to help you out with that mic. He's like, thank God, I've been looking for that.
we should do Borat 2 as one of the Lot Awful movies. Ooh, we could do that.
Interesting.
Okay. So a lot of people have been asking, right? Like, how do you get this? What happens? Does this mean Rudy's about to be arrested? And so I thought that was worth breaking down. So federal search warrant, what that means is that you have an affidavit from somebody, an FBI agent or other investigator, showing probable cause that evidence of a crime is at a particular location or on a particular person. Okay. So I'm going to include a link in the show notes to a sample one of these. This is from an entirely different case in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. It's a In Re Susan Powell. But it's the same kind of thing that they just executed with respect to Rudy. And so what you get is you get a cover page that says, I state your name, being duly sworn to pose and say, I am a, and then you give your title, and I have reason to believe, and then you check the box, that either on the person of or on the property or premises, and then you describe where that is, 123 Fake Street. In this particular district, there is now concealed a certain person or property, namely, and then you describe what it is that you want to find, which is evidence of the commission of a criminal offense, the fruits of the crime, and property designated or intended for use for which it has been used as a means of committing a criminal offense occurring in violation of, and then you have to specify what particular federal offense it is. And then it says the facts are as follows, and you attach an affidavit. And this affidavit is like 14 pages long. And it just describes the investigation that you've done and why you then believe that you have probable cause to think that evidence of a criminal of a crime is at that particular location. And I mentioned that, by the way, the target, and so you fill out that application, you give that to a U.S. magistrate judge, and then the magistrate judge reads and evaluates and makes a determination and says, yes, you've shown probable cause. I'm going to issue a search warrant. Or no, you haven't. Come back when you got more. And that's, by the way, that is a real determination, right? Like, you know, we go through the, you know, a grand jury will indict a ham sandwich kind of thing. But magistrate judges take seriously the notion of looking at an affidavit and deciding whether it shows probable cause. Now, probable cause is not as high as 50%, right? It is probable, right? It, you know, it's, the reason, you know, that we have that way is to balance between the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, right? So the Fourth Amendment says you have a right to be secure in your home, your persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. And so no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
Right. So you need some specificity there. You can't just be like, yeah, I think, which is tough with Giuliani, because my affidavit would have been like, yeah, look at him. Your Honor, look. Yeah, there's crime. There's got to be crime. Just look at him. Look at that guy.
And again, we also have, you know, exhibit number a billion in originalism is stupid, right? Like, you know, what's a reasonable search? What's an unreasonable search, right? Yeah. You know, what does it mean to describe something with particularity, right? Like all of that. And the answer to all of that is check the case law, right? So, you know, for example, in the Fourth Circuit, the particularity requirement is really, really minimal. I know, because I worked on a case where we lost one of these, you know, and it was just like, well, we want stuff that you used in criming. And the Fourth Circuit upheld that and said, yeah, stuff that you used in criming is enough to particularly describe the things to be seized.
Wait, that's how you lost?
Oh, yeah.
That was good enough?
Yeah, it was good enough.
Oh.
It's bad.
Wouldn't that apply to anything?
Like yes.
Okay.
So, I mean, without going down that rabbit trail.
Okay. But, let it suffice to say that this feels like it could be abused, or at least judges could do a bad job, or, you know,
it that happen a lot? It certainly could. And remember that the reason you employ this is because of the interplay between the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, which says no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And so, look, Rudy knows the crimes that he's committed. But if you ask him, right, if you're like, oh, okay, Mr. Giuliani, like,
he might actually tell you.
He might. Very true. But a hypothetical person would say, I decline to answer on the grounds anything I say might tend to incriminate myself and assert my Fifth Amendment privilege. And so you don't just want to give up at that point. So if you can prove probable cause, again, has to be, it's less than certainty, right? Less than 50, 51 to 49. But it's more than just a fishing expedition. Classic example, right? Thomas, a police officer, observes you. And then the next day you have a brand new car and it's, you know, it's an expensive tricked out SUV. And right, and the cop says, well, that, you know, if Thomas were a drug dealer, that would certainly explain why he was able to afford a fancy new car. I'm going to go, I mean, this would be a state law issue, but, you know, whatever. I'm going to go to a judge and I'm going to get a search warrant that allows me to go ransack Thomas's house looking for evidence that he deals drugs because, dang, you know, after all, fancy new car. Well, you know, that would not be probable cause, right? Because, yeah, it is slightly more likely, right? Like, you know, a person is slightly more likely to be a drug dealer if they have bought a new car. But there are just so many other confounding factors that wouldn't rise to the level of probable cause. Ultimately, you know, what this says is that there is an affidavit floating around out there that explains why Rudy Giuliani and his personal effects, right? And it was an iPad, a laptop, and a cell phone, that there was probable cause to believe that there was evidence of a crime or crimes on those items. Until we know more, until we see the affidavit, until somebody's charged, that's all we can say. That's more than nothing.
I feel like this is just guaranteed to bring up the conspiracy theorists and the right, you know, and that this will be Biden going after his political opponent, blah, 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 blah. Is this DOJ or what? Sorry, what office is this? Like, who's doing this specifically?
Oh, yeah, this is federal. This is DOJ. Okay. And this is, the story broke during the Trump administration. So, you know, the speculation, and we should add one more thing that we know as a matter of fact, and we know this and can demonstrate it from the Michael Cohen search, and that is when you are executing a search warrant against an attorney, internal DOJ procedures require you to run that
taint team.
Yeah, well, there is almost certainly a taint team sorting through what's been what's been seized.
I'll get in the van.
I'll start the theme song. But yeah, no, so it has absolutely been approved at the director level or higher, leading to, as again, some speculation, and that's all you can say, that Bill Barr personally intervened and prevented this search warrant from being executed. Again,
Okay. You know,
right, speculation. We cannot say he definitely did. Mm-hmm. We can say that doesn't seem out of character for Bill Barr.
Yeah, that is his character. He's that character.
He is that character.
The thing he does best. Wow.
But we don't know.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Lucy. Lucy Nicotine is a company founded by Caltech scientists and former smokers looking for a better and cleaner nicotine alternative. Finally, tobacco alternatives that don't suck. This was researched and developed for 3 years to be made for people, not patients. Lucy has created a nicotine gum with 4 milligrams of nicotine that comes in 3 flavors, wintergreen, cinnamon, and pomegranate. And Lucy also has a lozenge with 4 milligrams of nicotine in the cherry ice flavor. Each and every flavor actually tastes great, and it's convenient and discreet. Products can be enjoyed anywhere, on flights, at work, on the go, or even in the gym. So if you are someone who wants to make the switch from cigarettes to a cleaner alternative, Lucy can help you. It's 2021. Get rid of your cigarettes, unplug your vape, throw out your dip, and get some Lucy nicotine gum or lozenges. This is the real deal. A subscription to Lucy comes directly to your door each month, so it's simple and you don't have to leave your house because Lucy has delivery down. Opening Arguments listeners, go to lucy.co and use promo code OPENING to get 20% off of all products on your first order, including gum or lozenges. That's Lucy, LUCY.co, and use promo code OPENING at checkout. Also, I have to give this disclaimer, warning, this product contains nicotine derived from tobacco. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Lucy.co, and be sure to use that promo code OPENING. Down. Down. Okay, reapportionment. Oh boy, this feels like the deepest of deep dives. Here we go. What's going on?
So I want to start out and tell you, there's a little bit of pedantry here, but that's some of my favorite things to do. Every story that you have read about reapportionment in the press is wrong.
Hmm.
And here's what I mean by that. All of them have said, right, Texas has gained 2 electoral votes.
Yeah.
North Carolina, Florida, Oregon, Colorado, Montana have gained 1. And California, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, New York, Michigan, and West Virginia have lost 1. You kind of add those up in your head and you're like, well, depending on if the Democrats can Stacey Abrams their way in Texas, you know, maybe this is a push. Maybe it's a slight Republican gain. Here's what I want to tell you. None of those states have anything right now.
Well, right now, yeah.
But none of them are entitled to begin redistricting right now, because what has happened is an internal report has been sent to the president from the acting director of the Census Bureau on behalf of the Secretary of Commerce. And that is a report pursuant to 13 U.S.C. Section 141B, which says that the tabulation of total population by states as required for apportionment of the representatives in Congress shall be completed within 9 months after the census date. They missed that. And reported by the Secretary to the President of the United States. The legal right to do anything is not triggered until President Biden takes those numbers and transmits them to the Congress. And if that sounds a little like, okay, but, you know, is this one weird tricky? It really isn't, Okay. And
well, we did a whole thing on this, right?
We did
this
indeed.
We talked about this.
Yep. This was episode 307 in which we were concerned.
Because this has been in my mind the whole time. I'm so glad we're covering this because I've been worried that we've, you know, maybe undercounted the Latino population, maybe other problems due to the question that was going to be in there and then wasn't in there and then was. So do we have a maybe a chance to repair these numbers or what?
We do. So we have two distinct steps in which we can address these numbers. And that's why it was very important. And yeah, it was a little clickbaity, for, you know, audio clickbait, whatever you might listen.
Well, who knows
baby.
What I'll title this.
Right.
Andrew says every news story is wrong. Yeah. Might be the title by now.
But right now, President Biden has the discretion to look at these numbers. And remember, we covered this on day one. Biden issued an executive order directing that the census be a full and complete count and that it not discriminate on the basis of citizenship status, which is what's required by the law. And that went out. That was a specific instruction to the Secretary of Commerce and to his delegates, which include the acting director of the Census Bureau. And so Biden is well within his authority to say, okay, well, now we got to take a look at the numbers you sent me and make sure that they are consistent with that executive order. And the states can't do anything about that until that is transmitted. And again, this is clear from a 9-0 Supreme Court case that we talked about in episode 307 called Franklin versus Massachusetts, which says there is no statute forbidding the amendment of the census itself after the secretary submits the report to the president. Moreover, there is no statute that rules out an instruction by the president to the secretary to reform the census even after the data are submitted to him. It is not until the president submits the information to Congress that the target stops moving, because only then are states entitled by Section 2A, that is 2 U.S.C. 2A, to a particular number of representatives. Because the secretary's report to the president carries no direct consequences for reapportionment, it serves more like a tentative recommendation than a full and binding determination. So that's as clear as the Supreme Court gets to say President Biden can take the time he needs to look at the data, to make sure that the underlying data is accurate, to question how it was compiled. He can do all of that, and there is nothing, there is no cause of action. There is no right, right? The target is allowed to keep moving until he transmits that data. So that's our step one.
Right. But is there anything substantive that may, you know, actually let us change these numbers? Do we have any way of knowing that now?
Well, put a pin in that. Okay. There's a short answer to that question, which is no, we do not have affirmative evidence right now, which is why you study them, right? And why you figure it out. But when I get to how these numbers were calculated, I think you'll be surprised. So now, the person who transmitted these numbers is Ron Jarman, the acting director of the census. He's an economist. He's a career numbers guy. He's been at the Census Bureau since 1992. So he was there under Trump, but like, seems like a career civil servant. No reason to distrust him, but also no reason to think that they performed, you know, additional scrutiny. We just don't know. Now I want to talk about how the numbers work. And I'm going to include the link. The census website includes all of these Excel tables. What you don't have publicly available are how the counts were achieved in the first place, right? That's what we really need to figure out to determine if there was suppression. But the data we do have is really, really fun to play around with. And if you are a math geek or pretensions of one like me, you will get lost in this. So click on the link from the show notes. I now understand how this gets turned into members of Congress. It took me about a day and a half to figure this out. So the Constitution, right? Article 1, Section 2 requires an actual enumeration every 10 years of the residential population of the United States. So actual enumeration means you got to really count all the real people who live here. That number is just under 335 million people. But you can't turn that into Congress people yet, because first you have to subtract out some stuff. Why do you have to subtract out some stuff? Because the 335 million includes 3.3 million people who live in Puerto Rico. They should have 4 congressional seats, by the way, and 689,000 people who live in the District of Columbia, which is more than Vermont or Wyoming. So you got to subtract out those numbers, and then you have to put some numbers in. And we talked about this in episode 307 with Opening Arguments good friend Richard Nixon, right, who instructed the Commerce Department to include in the census U.S. military and federal civilian employees living overseas who would then become residents of their home state for apportionment purposes, right? Because they're not living here, so they're not part of the residential population, but they have a right to live here. And, you know, this was kind of post-Vietnam War, and Nixon's thought was, I will gain a strategic advantage for the Republican Party because we will be counting mostly Republican voters abroad. And he was able to pitch it in, really, you're going to say that, you know, somebody who's been drafted
the military and shouldn't have the right to be represented.
Right.
This is why Nixon was so much smarter than Trump. Like, Trump would have never thought of something like this.
Correct. Correct. So that gets added in. But I want to tell you, again, put a pin in this, these numbers are pretty small. It's about 350,000 people nationwide, and only 4 states have more than 15,000. That's California, Texas, Florida, and Virginia. So, okay, so you start out with the residential population, you subtract out Puerto Rico and DC, and then you add in those 350,000 citizens living abroad, and then you get the apportionment population. And that is a fixed number, 331,108,434. So I thought you just divide that by 435, right? So you get one for every 761,168.8, right? So every 761,169 people, you get one congressional representative. If you do that, you do not get the right result. And let's use New York as an example. New York has 20,215,751 people. You divide that by 761,168.8, and you get 26.56. That should round up to 27, right? That's how many seats New York has, but they're losing one with this census. So why are they losing one? And you might think, oh, well, okay, 26.56, maybe another state with, like, you know, 4.8 needs to round up. So
yeah, I was thinking, is it rounding in the really small states or something, or because they at least need a certain number?
Yes and no. Yeah. Montana is gaining an extra seat, but you take Montana's population, that's 1,085,407, you divide that by 761,169, and you get 1.42. So wait a second. Why is it that we're going to round up? What, okay, 142, that should round down to one, right? Or at minimum, if you're not going to round up 44 one-hundredths, why would you round up 58 one-hundredths, right? And I was totally befuddled by this until I dug into the law. And the answer is 2 USC Section 2B, the one I mentioned earlier. And it says, and I'm going to cut out the middle part that doesn't matter. It says, each state shall be entitled to the number of representatives based upon the method known as the method of equal proportions, with no state to receive less than one member. And I'm like, all right, I get that last part. Every state gets at least one. What the hell is the method of equal proportions? It was invented by a guy named E.V. Huntington in the 1920s. E.V. Huntington has no Wikipedia entry, right?
Wow.
Yeah, this guy's lost to time, but codified in our law. I'm going to explain the math in a minute, but here's the best analytical explanation that I can come up with. If you took Montana's seat and gave it to New York, then New York would go from, let's assume all these numbers are correct, right? And so the reason why Montana gets the seat and New York doesn't is we're stuck at 435. Mm-hmm. So every time you give to one, you take away from somebody else. So you take it away from New York. If you do the reverse, then New York would go from, with 26 seats, they average 777,529 people per congressional district, Okay. The average is supposed to be 761, so they're taking a penalty of 16,500. And they go to 748,731 per district, which is a bonus of 12,400. So in other words, they would go from being a below average state of representation to an above average state over a lot of congressional districts. On the other hand, Montana would go from 542,000 people per district, which is a bonus of 219,000, making it the very best state in terms of having your voice heard, to 1,085,000 per district, which is a penalty of 324,000, which would make it the very worst state in order to vote. So figuring out how to weigh between the benefit and the harm of all of those people.
Plus, you're talking about just two states. I mean, I imagine this is a multi-state process.
You imagine correctly. Yeah. They came up with this algorithm that is bonkers, but
I would love to code this thing into Excel. That would be so fun. That's like what I did for my old job. I love it.
All right. So I'm going to explain the algorithm. We'll see if you can code it into Excel. But I want to start.
Take me more than the 10 minutes we have on the show.
It might. I want to start with, as we are thinking about structural reform to the court, to the Electoral College, you need to know that this method of apportionment, that the size of the Congress, that all of that, that does not require a constitutional amendment. It does not have to be this way.
Well, we've covered, we could just increase the number of representatives, couldn't we?
We could, and in fact, and I did not know this, for the first 60 years in our nation's history, they had a fluctuating size of the House because they just ignored the fractions, right? They're like, oh, they took
it's
it. They
the
added
1800s
up.
Math sucks. We don't know how to do it yet. Nobody has a calculator.
That's exactly correct. They were just like, just take the first one.
They're on their abacuses. They're like, I can't split one of the little thing stones, whatever those are. It's whole. We can't do it. Increase the Congress.
Yep.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Roman. Folks, squeaky doors, clogged sinks, finicky engines. When things break around the house, you take care of it. However, when something's off in the bedroom, some people just try not to think about it. But come on, what are you waiting for? Take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/opening now. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. A U.S. licensed healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, it ships to you free with 2-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/opening and complete an online visit. Take care of your ED without leaving your home. Complete an online visit today to connect with a healthcare professional and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/opening now and you'll get $15 off your first month. It's really time to take care of your ED. And remember, get started today and you'll save $15 on your first order of ED treatment. One more time, GetRoman.com/opening.
And it continued. So it was that way for the first six censuses. Then in 1840, they finally started doing a little bit of math where they just rounded up anything with a 0.5.
Nice.
So, under that, New York would get its seat and you would just, if that meant you went to 436, so be it. What the hell? 435 isn't magic, right?
Yeah.
Then they started with the total number of seats based on the total population, and they allocated it out based on whole numbers, figured out how many seats were left, and then went and gave them in sort of inverse order of the fraction. So I know that seems a little, I'm not describing it the best I can, but if we were doing it that way, you would give New York a seat at 26.56, right? That's before you would give Montana at 1.42, right? Because 0.56 is better than bigger than 0.42. Then we capped it all at 435, and that led to, in 1920,
that makes it really hard.
This problem, this actually happened. Between 1910 and 1920, Alabama gained population Don't ask me why, but more people, sorry to our listeners in Alabama, that's a cheap shot, I'm joking. More people were living in Alabama in 1920 than were in 1910. Other states lost population, as always happens, right? And yet, Alabama lost a representative while those other states didn't. And as you can imagine, Alabama was super pissed, yeah, right? They were like, wait a minute.
We need that seat for racism purposes.
It was 1920. Everybody needed that seat for racism purposes.
That's a good point. I'm sure they had competing racism purposes. Our racism purposes are better than yours. Give us the seat back.
But that seems insane, right? Like, you can't have more people,
yeah,
and lose a seat while other states lose people but stay the same. But what happened was, in 1910, they had a slightly bigger fraction that rounded up. They gained, that fraction got even bigger, but the other states grew by even more, so that fraction got taken away to give to those other states. So it left
not
with
the,
just,
you're not saying not the states that lost population, because you said they lost population, but other states that had
third-party states that had gained even more.
Gotcha. So it lowered their fraction a little bit, and so they didn't get the extra spot anymore.
Yep, okay. Exactly right. And so E.V. Huntington came up with the method of equal proportions to make sure this never happens again.
I was just about to make really disparaging jokes about Huntington. He's like, not on my watch will Alabama lose its seat for racism purposes. But then I don't want to be sued by the family of E.B. Huntington. So never mind.
Nobody knows who he is. So I think we're in good shape, right?
E.B. Huntington took off his hood and was like, damn it, I'm going to do some math. God.
This podcast is not insinuating that E.V. Huntington is a member of the Ku Klux Klan.
I'll cut it. It's fine.
No. I think you should keep it in. It's funny as hell. Anyway, and it's based on, and the first thing is, and this almost doesn't matter, but I know you know what it is and you're going to geek out a little bit about it. So it's based on the geometric mean rather than the arithmetic mean. Yeah.
You're
going
to have to refresh me, though. I can't remember.
I had to refresh myself on this.
Some years.
So everybody knows what the arithmetic mean is. 2 plus 8. So the arithmetic mean of 2 and 8 is 5, right?
Sure.
2 plus 8 equals 10 divided by 2 equals 5. Geometric mean is almost exactly the same, particularly as numbers get bigger. But what you do is you take the product of the two quantities and then take the square root, right? Or the nth root if it's multiple. So the geometric mean of 2 and 8 is 2 times 8. Is 16, the square root of that is 4.
Right.
So geometric mean of 2 and 8 is 4. Arithmetic mean is 5. As your numbers get larger, those two converge, which I will show you, right? So for example, going from 29 to 30, the arithmetic mean is 29 and a half. The geometric mean is 29 times 30, which is 870. Take the square root, which is 29.4958. So as I explain geometric mean here, if you're still confused by it, you can just think of it like an average and you'll get almost all the way there. Here's how the method of equal proportions works. This is what you have to code into Excel and good luck.
Ooh.
First, you allocate 50 seats, right? Because every state's got to get one seat.
Yep. Okay.
Then for the 51st seat, you figure out each state's priority value for a second seat in Congress. Okay. And that priority value is the geometric mean multiplied by the population of the state. What, the inverse of the geometric mean for that seat number multiplied by the population of the state. I know that's going to require a little unpacking. So let's do it for seat number 2. You're going from seat 1 to seat 2. So arithmetic mean would be 1.5, right? Halfway between 1 and 2. The geometric mean's a little harder, but it's 1 times 2, which is 2, and then you take the square root. Square root of 2 is 1.414. So like I said, the geometric mean is going to get closer and closer to the arithmetic mean, but it's right now it's a slightly smaller number, 1414. So then you divide every state's population by that 1.414 number. Now, this is the first seat, so
this is the second seat, right?
Well, this is the second seat, the first one that we're allocating by priority value. Uh-huh. So who shows up the highest?
Just whatever the biggest state is.
Yeah, California.
Sure.
Population of 40 million, because every state is getting divided by 1.414. Mm. So the state with the most population, California, 40 million, priority number 28 million, and it gets the 51st seat.
Okay.
So think about what that means. That means if we had a Congress of 51, then right. every state would get one representative, except mm-hmm. California would get two.
Okay. I guess I've spent a lot of brain matter trying to figure out why the geometric mean matters there. Like, I'm curious if old Huntington justifies this in any conceptual way, or if it was just one weird trick to get some more racism congressmen.
No, it
because the same calculation would absolutely apply with the mean.
It would, but now let's iterate the process.
Okay, let's iterate. Let's iterate, everybody.
Okay, so now let's go from 51 seats in Congress to 52. How do you do that? Same thing. For every state with one representative, that's all of them but California, you take that 1.414 and multiply it by their population. California already has two seats, so their number is three, right?
Right. And so it's two how do to we three. Get,
how do we get that right? So yeah. 2.3, it, again, that'd be 2.5 if we did the arithmetic mean, but since it's geometric, we get 2 times 3, which is 6, and the square root of 6 is 2.449. So, look, we're real close to 2.5
already.
Still
not figuring out why that matters, but okay.
I don't know. Yeah, okay.
We'll see.
So California gets that new priority value. They get 40 million divided by 2.449, or a little over 16 million, right?
So I'm guessing that'll still put them ahead of a lot of states, but it will put them New York. Or
it will put them ahead of – it actually still puts them ahead of New York.
Really?
It puts them ahead of every state without 23 million people in it.
Wait, you're telling me that California is so much bigger than New York that it would get a third? If there are only 52, it would get two before New York got – one extra one?
It would get three before New York gets two. Yes, indeedy.
Wow, that's crazy.
I know, isn't it? So, but we do have one state that has more than 23 million people. That's Texas with 29 million people, right? So its priority value for seat two is now almost 20 million, and it gets the 52nd seat. And then you do the same calculation again for 53rd, and as you just worked out, that's California again. So let that sink in for a second. If we had a Congress with 53 seats, based on the 2020 census numbers, that would be 48 states get one, Texas would get two, and California would get three.
Oh, I guess I just didn't realize California was that much bigger than theirs. Okay, so it's not that the math is weirder than I thought. It's that I'm just totally wrong about the population. I didn't realize California is just about twice as populous as New York. Okay. That's crazy. I did not know that.
So I'm not going to go through all the rest of the iterative
math. No, let's do it. But every single one, Andrew. We're going to crunch these numbers.
But that's what you have to do to get to 435.
I was going to say earlier, it must be an iterative process, you know, where you do one at a time. And that kind of avoids the, like, when you've got multiple states with rounding, you know, and you're not sure, like, okay, which one gets the extra one? I figure there must be some stepwise process that would get you there.
But now what I want you to understand is, wherever you stop in this stepwise process, you're going to screw somebody. Every stop is unfair, right? Mm-hmm. So
if
you stop at 51, every state but California gets screwed, right?
Sounds fair to me.
If you stop at 52, California is actually screwed more than any other state but Texas, right? Because Texas would get two reps for 29 million people, averaging about 14.5 million per seat. California will have two for 40 million people, which is averaging 20 million people a seat. And Wyoming gets one for 578,000 people, right? Yeah. So the census has published the data. Oh my God, the iterated data all the way down to seat 435 and then the next 10. Right. Which is super fun.
Just to let us know, like, hey, if you want to increase by 10, here's what it would look like.
Well, hold on to your butt. Okay. Seat 435 is Minnesota's 8th congressional seat.
Ugh, okay. What a waste. No, I mean, good for Minnesota.
The priority value to Minnesota for that seat is 762,997.705. Okay. Now, that's just an average. That number inherently doesn't mean anything. But I want you to understand this. New York would be seat 436. Their priority value for that 27th seat is 762,994.352. If you multiply that back out by the population, what that means is if the census were to show that New York had 89 more people in the state of New York, then New York's priority number would move ahead of Minnesota. So Minnesota would lose that district and it would go back to New York. And so instead of losing one, New York would stay even, and now Minnesota would be in the losing one category. This is important because when we are talking about having standing to challenge the count, New York, it is every court on, right, 89 votes out of,
sorry,
89 votes, 89 people out of 21 million is an infinitesimal percentage, right?
That's like, why I've been wondering. So like anything that changes these numbers, even in the slightest, could have a cascading effect, like even in any other state, right? Like some numbers anywhere could possibly, because of the weird way this is calculated, disrupt the entire sequence of calculations.
You have immediately perceived the conclusion that I was trying to lead people to, and that is, it is not just New York that has, so like, consider this, right, over seat 435. Yeah, New York, okay, you definitely have standing because the 89. Well, but now Minnesota gets standing, even though Minnesota would need 11,000 more people to move up to 434, but they get standing because they'll lose their seat if New York moves up. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you start going up the thing, right, it disrupts the entire chain of all the states below it, right? And so, you know, so the last couple of states that are in are Minnesota, Montana, California, seat 52, Colorado, Oregon, North Carolina, Alabama, Rhode Island, Illinois. It's a weird hodgepodge of states that could have their congressional districts threatened based on movement by this priority value number at the very, very bottom of the iterative chain. It's super duper interesting. And it's super bad for like a stable democracy. But if you are a law geek and a numbers geek like I am, then I think you understand why I had so much fun putting together this segment. So,
I didn't think this would be that much fun, but I loved it.
There you go. That's what's on deck. And the takeaway of all of that is, I still don't understand why they use the geometric mean.
Yeah, I'm really trying to think conceptually how that would be. So it'd be like, when it's a lower number of seats, you want, like, that's really the only difference. When you get, I guess it would prioritize when a state is going from, you know, a high number, like California, for example, 51 to 52, that's going to be closer to the average between those, the regular mean, than when you're going from 1 to 2 or something. Is that just a way of maybe prioritizing one or the other of those situations?
That's right. It's a way of striking that balance as between and really happened here, right? Between Montana and New York, because if you if you adopt a different method, if you adopt the straight average method,
spreadsheet, I'm gonna be able to plug in what the regular mean would get you.
Oh, I love it.
How many Patreon dollars for that spread? That'd be a lot of work for nothing. So I don't know if I have time to do it. Can I release it to patrons for? No, I'm just kidding. That would be a lot of fun, though. I honestly would love to do that.
So there you go. That's everything I could possibly come up with about apportionment, and I hope you loved geeking out as much as I did.
But the key takeaway is this is maybe still subject to change, possibly.
Yes, exactly right.
Okay, I love it. I'm glad. I want there to be a way that I don't lose a seat and New York doesn't maybe lose a seat to Minnesota. No offense to Minnesota, but just for the blue-red purposes, I guess this could all even out somehow, depending on how elections and map drawing goes, but who knows? This podcast is brought to you by the X Chair. I love my new X chair. I am sitting in it right now, and you folks probably know I spend a lot of time sitting in a chair, whether it's recording away, streaming, editing, and I have never had an office chair that looks and feels so amazing in my entire life. It's so comfortable, I can sit for hours, and I have to, and never feel uncomfortable. The secret is not only their patented dynamic variable lumbar DVL support, which offers unbelievable lumbar support to my lower back, but now, thanks to their new XHMT technology, I can also get heat and massage therapy while I'm sitting at my desk. If you're someone like me who has to spend a lot of time sitting down in your office chair, you might want to try this XHMT stuff. It delivers heat and massage technology right to your core, It increases blood flow, muscle recovery, and energy. These are all perks that make working from home or the office a joy. It even has 4 different massage modes and a fast warming heat technology for when I'm sore. You won't believe the X Chair difference until you feel it for yourself. So the X Chair is on sale now for $100 off. Go to xchairoa.com now. That's the letter X, chair, and the letters O and A.com, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. Go to xchairoa.com now and use code XWheels for free X-Wheel blade casters. That's xchairoa.com. Go there now.
What I hear when I'm being yelled at is people caring loudly at me.
Okay, quick important feedback. Let me read this feedback that you and I both got here. So Michael commented on Patreon, "I think you sort of downplayed the distinction between knowing a client is lying and suspecting a client is lying." This is, of course, about our most recent episode. "As you correctly noted, in the former case, the lawyer's ethical obligation not to suborn perjury by the client, but in the latter case, mere suspicion, if a lawyer were to refuse to put the witness on the stand, wouldn't that lawyer be usurping the jury's role as a fact finder? What about this option? The lawyer puts the client on the stand and lets them give their testimony in narrative form, with the lawyer asking no questions and thus not eliciting perjured testimony." That's interesting.
Yeah, this was super interesting. Really smart by Michael. I want to make 2 points. This all come from Rule 3.3A3 that we discussed in the last episode. So first, just to make this very, very clear, and this will come into play when we get to our second bit of feedback. Rule 3.3A3 says a lawyer shall not knowingly offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. Repeating that word knowingly should give you a pretty big hint here. It applies only to evidence that you know is false.
Yeah.
If you merely suspect that it's false, the rules are 100% clear and the ethics are 100% clear. You can't refuse to let your client testify. Okay. And I thought we made this pretty clear in the last episode.
Yeah, I think you did, definitely. I think I want to take some blame for clouding this, because I think I was talking about Dershowitz more, because I think that guy's a scumbag, and I was using him as more of an example. But yeah, I'm sorry if I kind of colored the way that people were perceiving this entire segment, you know.
No. We got a ton of feedback. We got a lot of people who thought we were too kind to, you know, criminal scumbags. And yeah. Really? And then we got a lot, you know, we got one in particular from Public Defender, and you know, Public Defenders are heroes, that thought, well, hey, you know, we're kind of playing into that trope of, you know, guilty people don't deserve representation. So that actually makes me feel pretty happy about the segment, right? Like if everybody's a little bit unhappy, then, you know, probably we did a good job. But I thought there were great points that were worth clarifying. So first, the rules are crystal clear. It's comment nine interprets that sentence. And it says, "This rule does not permit a lawyer to refuse to offer the testimony of a client where the lawyer reasonably believes but does not know that the testimony will be false. Unless the lawyer knows the testimony will be false, the lawyer must honor the client's decision to testify." Now, let's play that out a little bit. What do you do if you just strongly suspect that your client is lying to you and will lie on the stand? What I do is I practice cross-examination. Right. And I have actually had this.
Wow.
In one of the very few criminal cases, it was a CJA panel that I volunteered to take up because a judge asked me to about 15 years ago. And it's one of the few times I've represented a party. This was a witness who had been given immunity and was being called to testify in a criminal proceeding, but was being called to testify about to give testimony that included crimes that my client had committed, right? And so there were a lot of kind of minefields to navigate. And I suspected that that my client was not being fully truthful to me. And I said, okay, what we're going to do here is we're going to practice cross-examination because you're going to get cross-examined by the prosecutor on the stand. I believe you, and I'm on your side. So if I can think of questions, then I promise you the other side can think of these questions, right? And then you go after them with your cross-examination questions and see what their answers are. And if they give terrible answers, like I will stop in the middle and I'll be like, you do understand, right? You just contradicted the question I gave last time. And then the client will say, as said to me, like, yeah, but you know, they probably won't ask that. And I'll say, yeah, they probably will. Like that's what lawyers do. And so you can use that as leverage to persuade your client not to testify. And again, the reason to do this is not because guilty people don't deserve representation. It is because your best zealous advocacy on behalf of a guilty client is not to stick them on the stand and let them perjure themselves and look like an idiot.
Sure.
Right? Because, yeah, right. Like, it's, you know, it's not about they have a right. But, like, if you were taking seriously your duty to that client, that is to try and not put them in a position where they're going to wind up with the worst possible outcome. So that's why I did that, right? You know, and to say, look, if you can't answer the questions for me, maybe you're not going to be able to answer them when you're on the stand. But at the end of the day, if you cannot persuade them, the rule is clear. If you merely suspect but do not know, that's not reason. Client's wishes trump. It also means that when you are evaluating these two competing principles, that you should probably err on the side of zealous advocacy, right? So comments 8 and 9 talk about what you can do when you suspect something to be false, right? So comment 9, quote, permits the lawyer to refuse to offer testimony or other proof that the lawyer reasonably believes is false, end of quote. So in other words, you have discretion as a lawyer to decide what testimony you're going to put on when you merely believe it to be false. That decision is taken away from you when there's a core right at stake, which is the right of a criminal defendant to testify on their behalf. The second part, the rest of Rule 3.3A3 also includes a remedial instruction, right? So it says a lawyer shall not knowingly offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. And then that continues. It says if a lawyer, the lawyer's client, or a witness called by the lawyer has offered material evidence and the lawyer comes to know of its falsity, meaning later, right? The lawyer shall take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the tribunal. A lawyer may refuse to offer evidence other than the testimony of a defendant in a criminal matter that the lawyer reasonably believes is false. We already talked about that last part. So that remedial step, I think, means you can't get around the process by introducing, you know, by having the narrative testimony, by just sticking a guy on the stand and being like, all right, why don't you tell the jury your story? Because in a normal case, if you come to know that any testimony you have previously introduced is false, and again, no, you have a duty, shall take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the tribunal. So you can't just say, okay, well, I'm not eliciting the testimony. You know, I'm not pulling the strings. You're just talking. But if you come to know that the testimony your witness put up is false, you have to correct it. Wow. So I wrote back to Michael, and Michael said, well, that's weird because that idea of just putting the person on the stand actually comes from an ABA pattern instruction, American Bar Association pattern instruction. And I was like, really? What gives? And I went and I took a look at it. And it turns out there's this interesting wrinkle I didn't know about. And that is some jurisdictions have raised, remember, you've got sort of the competing rights of, you know, the lawyer to not suborn perjury and the defendant to testify if they decide they want to. Some jurisdictions have ruled that the defendant's right to testify is an absolute privilege. And what that means is your client says, I want you to put me on the stand. And I say, Thomas, you've already confessed to me. I can't put you on the stand. Mm-hmm. You'll perjure yourself. You say, too bad. And I have no idea if California is one of these jurisdictions. But you say, too bad, California is one of those jurisdictions in which I have an absolute right to go on the stand. And if you are, then I have to put you on the stand. And then the ABA has said, and what you should do is stay away from questions where you know he's going to.
That makes sense.
Yep. And give him the narrative approach.
Like, it honestly kind of makes sense that you should have the right to go on the stand, really, like in your own trial. Like, I mean, whatever. It's probably not a good idea, but like, you should have the right to be like, I will answer all these charges, Your Honor. Goldfinch on the flag. This is not a real court.
And again, I would use the way in which the rules operate as a persuasive tool in that case, right? And I would say, okay, you are correct. You have an absolute right to take the stand. I am instructed by the ABA, so as not to elicit perjury, to put you on the stand and ask you to give a narrative explanation of events. You will notice, having sat next to me this entire trial, that I have done that with no other witnesses. Mm. And if you think, like, is the jury going to say, Dalek's kind of weird? The jury's going to say, Dalek's kind of weird. And opposing counsel is going to say, Dalek's kind of weird. And so I think you're going to be putting yourself in danger. But you're right. If you insist on taking the stand, go ahead, take the stand. That would be where I come out of it. So I love that comment. We also received, I think, a really important email from a public defender. Disagree with a lot of it, but I want to address the points that were made on the air. It's going to be kind of a lengthy process. So so let's push that off until Tuesday so that we can give this person what they're doing. We're not trying to kind of run through it at the end of the episode. But rest assured, if you sat there and thought, well, seems like, Andrew's not giving great voice to, you know, what if you are defending clients that tend to be guilty a lot? Rest assured that I have heard that, and we will talk about that on the next episode.
Well, thanks as always for the fantastic feedback and questions, everybody.
And thank you!
And one more reminder about that Patreon Q&A, Tuesday the 4th at 3, as we thank our new patrons here. I think it is Andrew's turn to go first, so why don't you thank our new patrons, Andrew?
Thank you to COVID vaccine trial participation, and all I got was stabbed and Patreon money. Well, Zach Kaler, Rose Kinner, West Virginia listener here, reminding you that Jim Justice Anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. One vote for a live show in Huntsville, Alabama. Well, that's one more than we thought. Tracy and her five cats. Welcome back to Sarah Charlton.
You have to do some creative math a la the previous segment to get that show going.
Yeah, you can. If we use the less.
Not the geometric mean, not the arithmetic mean, but the freaking magical mean.
Tracy and her five cats. Welcome back to Sarah Charlton. D-Dev 127, That Thing in the Attic, oh my gosh, Michael Ruby, Mike Remington, Mark Van Buskirk, and PJ. Thomas, take it away.
Thank you to Stephen Roberts, Alex Zukowski, Rebecca Danker. Oh, Danker, what a great last name. However dank you think Rebecca is, she's actually Danker. Far Harder, Adam Schiavone, or Schiavone maybe, Trent Toulouse. Kirk Hall, Core, with a bunch of R's. Daniel Lindsay, Bag of Weasels. Bag of Weasels. Finally, we got that Bag of Weasels pledge. I've been lobbying hard for them. B. Reindl and Dit. Cool. Thanks so much, new patrons. We hope you enjoy the stuff and get in there on that Q&A thread. That's a perk that you now have, new patrons, and everybody else, we encourage you to do the same.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, and now it's time for T3BE, and I've just remembered, we're introducing the coin, Andrew. I'm going to beat the coin.
Really?
I'm going to Thomas' second chance it, and then I'm going to give my answer, and then I'm going to flip a coin, see what the coin said. And just by doing this, the coin will then cosmically become smarter than me. It's a really weird, mystical thing. So, all right, let's do it. Pork the streak.
Okay.
There we go, the coin.
I'm excited for this. Thomas, and you got off to a great footing here, constitutional law question. So,
I don't know how well the coin has studied that. We'll see.
A state law prohibits any barbershop licensed by the state from displaying posters in support of any current candidate for public office or displaying or distributing any campaign literature in support of such a candidate.
Huh.
No other kinds of posters or literature are subject to this prohibition, nor are any other types of commercial establishments in the state.
Oddly specific law.
Yeah, subject to similar prohibitions. Is the law constitutional?
Jeez.
A, no, because it treats barbershops differently from other commercial establishments. B, no, because it imposes a restriction on the content or subject matter of speech in the absence of any evidence that such a restriction is necessary to serve a compelling state
interest.
That's
definitely one of the answers.
C, yes, because it leaves political candidates free to communicate their campaign messages to voters by other means. Or D, yes, because the operation of a licensed barbershop is a privilege and therefore subject to any reasonable restriction by the state.
Wow. So a state law prohibits any barber. So just a barbershop. This is very like COVID related almost too. Like, I feel like that law, a good thing they didn't restrict a church from doing anything, because the answer would be no, the court will never let you restrict a church from doing anything. Anyway, barbershop says you can't display posters in support of any current candidate. That strikes me as very restrictive. Like that seems not constitutional. So I'm very much leaning toward no answers. A, no, because it treats barbershops differently from other commercial establishments. Maybe that's the no answer. B, no, because it imposes a restriction on the content or subject matter of speech in the absence of any evidence that such a restriction is necessary to serve a compelling state interest. A compelling state interest. I mean, that all sounds right to me, but is this going to be another case of which of the no answers is like more right or right better or right first, whatever. So me and the coin will have to battle that out. It's going to take a lot of convincing for me to think this is a yes answer. Like, yes, you can do this. Let's see. So we'll go through C and D. Yes, because it leaves political candidates free to communicate their campaign messages to voters by other means. So that's sort of taking like the candidates are the only ones at stake. You know, it's not talking about the barbershop, the free speech of the business owner. So I don't really think that could be right. I mean, it'd be weird to be like, no, the barbershop owner has no say. It's just about whether or not, the question is just about whether or not the candidates can communicate their campaign messages somewhere else. That can't be right. D, yes, because the operation of a licensed barbershop is a privilege and therefore is subject to any reasonable restriction imposed by the state. That's closer to a possible answer. You know, that is how we do some stuff. You know, it's like federal funded colleges, they're able to enforce like Title IX and whatever, that kind of stuff. But like, this is not a reasonable restriction. This feels like D would be true if it was some more reasonable thing, you know, that didn't involve like just free speech. It was some actual restriction. Then D could be right. But I'm solidly eliminating C and D. I don't know how you could say that this is a reasonable restriction. That makes no sense. So between A and B, let's see what I choose, and then we'll see what the coin chooses. So which will come into play first? Is it that the barbershop is getting treated differently, or is it that this is just a BS thing? And I think the way I'm going to try to answer this is to say, like, if the law prevented just all establishments from posting this kind of stuff, even though it's licensed by the state, so like everything that was licensed by the state, that still doesn't seem like it would be cool. So I'm going to go with B, because I do think it's more about imposing a restriction on the content or subject matter of speech in the absence of any evidence that such a restriction is necessary to serve a compelling state interest. Seems straightforward to me. I think it's straightfordly B. So let's see if I can beat the coin.
What is heads the coin pick?
Heads is it? Yeah, you didn't care what I have to say. You just want to know what the coin says. All right, I will note that I don't have a coin, so I'm flipping a pick. We can call this the pick of destiny. I'm flipping the pick of destiny here. A is the fender side is A, and the other side is B. Okay, here we go. Ready? Did I get it right? It's A. So it says A. Oh, I'm going to beat the coin. This coin can't be right. So the coin says A. I say B. Final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play against Thomas and the coin, you know how to do that.
Well, you can't beat Thomas and the coin. That's an unstoppable team. The best you could do is beat one of us.
Well, you could pick C or D, and one of those could be correct. In any event, whatever the permutations are, you know how to do that. Just share this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess. Include your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And that's our show, Andrew. What a fun math break. I may actually go make this spreadsheet. I'm not even joking. I might do it. Because I want to see how, like, if you change that average, like, how that changes everything. And we'll see. If I make it, look out in the Facebook group, I suspect, would be where I would post that. That's our show. We'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.